Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back.
That's right, that's right.
It's going to be us. We can drink and talk shit as much as we want. Nobody can say anything to us.
D.L. Hughley, uncut.
You know what it is. It is a D.L. Hughley uncut.
Dang. And coming in hot.
And I'm a D.L. Hughley. That's who I am.
I'm Jasmine Sanders.
And I am Jay Phillips.
There it is. Mm-hmm. I just want to say this, and we're going to move on fast because, you know, we got a lot of guests. But Donald Trump has gone from the president of the United States to a wedding crasher.
Yeah. Like, he talks about himself the whole time.
You know, like, you're the fucking ex-president of the United States. You don't crash people's weddings. He looks like Napoleon Dynamite's uncle. I used to be great.
Yeah,
remember me?
But he does. Wait, you. I would not expect anything less than him.
Yeah,
that,
man.
Not one thing.
He makes you call him Mr. President. No, nigga,
you
not.
You miss me
ex.
Yet? That's what he said.
No, we don't.
Then
he opened up his own website for him and Melania because he got kicked off of Twitter and everything else. So he said, "I'll run my own shit."
All I know is you're fucking up the toast. The groom, they're fucking up the toast. This orange dude, Orange Foolius, is fucking up the toast. I'm glad about a lot of things. I think that I've been watching the George Floyd trial, and I said on our broadcast that in order for Derek Chauvin to be found guilty, then George Floyd has to be found innocent of his own death. Because make no mistake, George Floyd is on trial for his own murder.
Yes.
So whatever he was guilty of, he already paid the ultimate price.
Yeah.
But I think that in order for him for George Floyd, for him to have exact any justice, society at large had to see him as a viable life. And one of the things that is happening, virtually everybody that testifies cries.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that's happening is the defense attorney is not so great.
No.
Like
you got 9 minutes and 26 seconds to show how horrible your dude is.
Yeah.
You have dispatchers calling and saying, you have police doing it, you have emergency paramedics saying, like, it's
and the sound bites that are saying
it is.
I call the police on the police.
Yeah.
And what I think is happening here, not only did we watch. Are people watching a man die? They're watching an idea die. And that idea is that police are there to do good all the time and that they're above reproach and that imagine these people having nightmares because not only did they watch a man die, but they watch someone who was there to help. Like, imagine if you had just called so the police would see if this was 20 was okay, and this is what happened.
Well, right. I also think it was very compelling when you listen to the young girl who did the video, the viral video, and she said, I stayed up all night apologizing to George Floyd.
Right.
Because when I saw him, I saw my father, my brother, my cousin, my uncle, and it was so compelling, and you could tell she really meant it. I think putting her on the stand.
What I think has to happen is you don't have to be a supporter of Black Lives Matter to know his life matter. You don't have to change your political ideology. But if you can watch that video and see anything but a murder, you're not part of the human condition.
And I like watching it. And I don't know which one of these guys it was, but they it just seemed like they was hell bent on trying to make him say that he was angry.
Yeah.
And it was like
MMA fighter.
Yeah. Like,
the only one who wasn't emotional was the dude who was doing all the killing.
Absolutely.
And you know who's not emotional? Sociopaths. And the other thing that's really in 26 states around the country, it is easier. You can vote on the same day. I mean, excuse me, you can buy a gun on the same day, but you can't vote. So what those states have said is the bullet is mightier than the ballot. Mm. My voice comes with an extra magazine. Is what they're saying. It's great.
It's so true. Welcome back to DL Uncut. Our first guest is a historian and documentary filmmaker. Please welcome Carrie Lee Merritt.
Hello, Miss Merritt. How
Hi
are
there.
You?
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You don't look like any documentarian or historian I've ever seen.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to change the face of that, right?
Ain't that the truth?
I did not expect this. I was ready to be bored. But now I'm kind of into it. It's great. It's great.
Oh, silly.
So I was recently in Jackson, Mississippi. I was performing there. And so, you know, we were, of course, there's a, I remember I was staying at a brand new hotel there, the only one, the Westin. And I gave my dog water. He travels with me. And he was sick the whole week. So I go find the vet, and they like, well, you know, you can't drink the water. And you can't take a bath in the water. Like, people who have cancer or other kind of kids can't drink the water. And I was talking to the one of my frat brothers about it, a brother named Wes. And he was saying that this has gone on in Jackson since his father was there. So this is a long-term problem. It's gone on for decades.
It's gone on for decades, and as a historian, I actually see it as a problem that has gone on essentially since the end of slavery and the failures of Reconstruction and the failures of any kind of reparations for African Americans in that state. And so what we see today is just an extenuation of that, you know, vast inequality in Mississippi. And, you know, the parts of Jackson, the suburbs of Jackson, the white suburbs, right, and the north of Jackson, right, where white people live,
right,
well, those pipes have been fixed.
Yes.
But the black areas of Jackson, the poorer areas, those are the areas that it was just a couple of weeks ago. It was really the end of March.
I was there at the beginning of March. Yeah,
right, we were
there.
Right. Yeah. So it was almost 6 weeks for them, either without water and then without clean drinking water.
But this is systemic. This is you say that you could trace this back to Reconstruction, to the end of slavery, right?
Absolutely. I mean, all of these problems that we're seeing across the South today, all of their the genesis of their problems are back in the mid-19th century.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Mississippi's not a state like Georgia or North Carolina or Texas. I had to call state Southern when it got chilly. And, okay, but I'll play along. But those states have a lot of people moving in and out. Mississippi's different. Like, people might have come back to retire or stuff like that, but their population is pretty static, pretty sedentary. And so there's it's a large black population, and there isn't an incentive. I don't know why there's an incentive to change, because, you know, people are aware what happens. But what do you think the drawback is? Do they believe it's just hopeless? Do they think that this is the way things have to be? Or I don't understand why over 100 years have yielded little to no change.
So that's a great question. And I think that the answer is multifaceted. One, there's a long history of really, really bad violence in Mississippi against anybody who's trying to organize, anybody who's trying to vote, anybody who's trying to change the system. So, you know, that's one thing. But second of all, you know, the people that were in slaveholding families, the richest families back in the 1850s and 60s, those are essentially the families that are still in power today. Those are the families, wealth never changed hands, power never changed hands. And so you still have very concentrated wealth and even, you know, jobs and everything like that.
Right.
It's a monopsony in these rural areas where you have one employer to essentially work for. So they control everything. Elite whites in that state control everything. And it's just been a matter of, we've got to get people organized and get a real good grassroots
it's interesting
movement
because
going on there.
The South, the Southern region of the United, like when people are, because I'm a liberal, and people always go, well, you know, what about these big cities? I'll explain Baltimore when you explain the entire Southern region of the United States of America, which is a solid block of poverty and sickness. 4% of black people live. So when everybody was like, look what has happened, look what liberals do, I'm like, generally, if you live in a more diverse state or a city, you're better educated, healthier, make more money. But these enclaves, a lot of these huge swaths of the South are just almost like antibiotics, like viruses can be resistant to antibiotics. They can be resistant to change.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the deep South, these states like Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, you also have the problem of a large poor white population.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so historically what elite whites have done in things like labor and any kind of economic banding together for political issues is they have whipped up as much racism and xenophobia as they could among poor whites whenever they needed, you know, them to align.
And it's not really
them.
That hard.
Yeah, they use them.
Alabama has the longest constitution in use in the world. And it's like 311,000 words, and all of them is to tell you what you can't do. Like, all of them is like, we hate black people,
right?
And what you can't, they can do the same thing in two words. No, no, nigga.
I thought it was so interesting that we're so progressive, like in many other areas, but for some reason, when it comes down to racism, when it comes down to just the systemic inequalities, it's not just the fight; it is getting people to even acknowledge that it still exists. Like, how do we get that?
I think Stacey Abrams has actually done wonders in Georgia from this perspective. Like, she has gone out into the rural, white areas in Georgia and really spoken to those people and told them what these kind of progressive and leftist and liberal policies would do to their lives, how it would actually change their lives in a positive way, not even really touching on race, but really explaining to them, because a lot of them really don't know. I mean, there is a huge gap in this country, obviously, as we've seen, especially over the last 4 years, and what people know about history and what they know about politics and civics, and most people are just completely uneducated.
But Georgia's very, like, a lot of people in Georgia aren't from there. Like, I always say, I always say, Joe Biden didn't win Georgia. He won Atlanta. And Mississippi and Alabama, I remember reading that the UN said that Alabama is the poorest place in the entire developed world. It's the poorest state. Like, it's the American Malawi. Madonna just go down there and start adopting kids. I don't even know why that does that. But they seem to be satisfied. You say that we need a new Civil War documentary, and I saw Gods and Monsters, or
Gods and Generals.
Gods and Generals, like, whatever. I stopped halfway through because I knew how it turned out. I was like, God, like, this is gonna be fucked up. But why do you think that would be helpful? A new Civil War documentary.
So the last major one was Ken Burns' Civil War documentary. Right. That's 30 years old.
Right.
So just that's mind blowing in itself. But I went back and watched the entire thing a couple of years ago and really realized how dated the history they use is. I mean, they essentially say that it's a war over states' rights.
Right.
They don't put the central blame on slavery. Right. So that's, red flag number one. They do other things like, don't talk about General Lee's slaveholding and kind of honor, some of the worst white supremacist, Klan members like Nathaniel Bedford Forrest.
Yes.
So we desperately need a new documentary that not only looks at, the white people who are fighting in the war, but looks at all of America during this time. And what my partner, Raylan Barnes at Princeton, and I want to do is really recenter the story to W.E.B. Du Bois's old theory that the enslaved freed themselves, right?
This was the biggest
labor strike in America that they freed themselves.
You know what's interesting? Like, in order to get a statue in America, a monument in America, you have to be brutal. There are more statues to Robert E. Lee than there are to Jesus, literally. And the only white dude who got a statue and that didn't brutalize black people was Rocky, and he beat the shit out of Apollo Creed. So but we're tied to this, like, you can't, and the schools that we go to are named after men who brutalize us. There was J. Marion Sims, who has up until recently had a statue outside of Columbia, and so our connection to racism, it's almost like this. American racism is like if, say, somebody gets an injury or a bullet wound, and the bullet, to take the bullet out is actually more detrimental to you, so you have to kind of learn to live with it. Trying to remove racism, because it's so embedded in our every, and just in every, like, you'd have to change holidays and schools and textbooks. So it's so ingrained in us that removing it would kill the host.
I think a lot of people, a lot of white people are starting to see that now. And I think white America has a long journey ahead. And luckily, I think there is some hope with that younger generation, as we've seen this past summer with the Black Lives Matter protests, that younger generation of white people are getting involved and are joining the movement and are really seeing how racist this country is at every level systemically.
Right.
And
we saw that in Georgia too with the voter suppression laws that they are passing, as they sit underneath, a slave plantation. It's freaking despicable.
But it's so, like, even the idea of capitalism is rooted in slavery. The idea of, I'm very interested in what happens with Amazon and Bessemer, Alabama, because Bessemer is a dope city if you on cops. Like, because I mean, the first 48 could actually just shoot Bessemer. But what happens if they're able to get a toehold, a union? Because people, I mean, there was this unions change significantly changed. Poor and middle class people. No, there virtually is no middle class now, but they changed a lot of people's lives. And then they were told by people on the right that unions are bad. The only unions they like are the police unions. That's the only ones that they like. But I think a lot of people are of the opinion that if it's good for black people, fuck it. I don't want it. Even though it'll lift me up. Because virtually everything good that happens for black people, America gets the benefit tenfold. Virtually. And so If a place like Bessemer, Alabama, and Amazon, if they're able to get a toehold in the deep, deep South like that, I really do think that could change not only a lot. I think more people move in. It becomes more diverse. Economic opportunities come. And then you have potentially a political change. So I think it's not just about a way of life. It's about changing virtually everything about the structure. Would you say?
Absolutely. I think it will be incredibly inspirational if they win, because, you know, this is something that the rest of the country hasn't been able to do, essentially. And I always argue that the South is the most progressive place in the United States because it is the poorest. I mean, it's just that there is such a power hold of white elites who control everything in this region, from labor laws to the carceral state to policing. I mean, we see in Bessemer, the police are literally being hired by Amazon to go and harass the workers.
Where's Norma Rae when you need her? Where's Norma Rae when you need her? I think that in the end, people always say things, dumb things to me, like it's not about black and white, it's about economics. No, it's still about large swaths of this country who believe, like, even if you look at what happened in the last election cycle, those people, 60%, 62% of white people, by and large, voted for Donald Trump. And they literally feel like he won because more of them wanted an effect than the other side. And that we don't really count anyway. Like, black people really don't count. And I think that that's why you have these suppressive measures in place, but they always vacillate. They always, I'm of the opinion that corporate America, at least in Georgia, I think that if those places are headquartered there, they're part of the fight, whether they want to be or not, that they employers can't bought them, you know, employees came for the opportunities. They give a lot of money to people who think like that politically, and they have a lot of sway. So if they say this can't happen, it won't.
That's exactly what's happening right now. Is I think the CEO of Delta just came out today and, you know, changed his complete tune about what's going on in Georgia. So, I mean, as we've seen in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, you know, money talks. Absolutely. Yep. Use boycotts, use whatever means you need to use to put pressure on these companies to not support these horribly racist policies.
Yeah.
You believe that there is a need for reparations, right?
I do, absolutely. And
you think it's restorative justice from a restorative justice aspect, or just a justice in general aspect? Like, why do you think, like, I know why I think there's a need for reparations, but why do you think that?
Oh, I think there's many, many reasons, from psychological repair for both blacks, whites, and indigenous people in the U.S., but mainly to repair our huge, huge racial wealth gap in this country, which is totally unconscionable. But I think not only did there need to be cash payments, like economists like Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton talk about, but then we've got to look at problems like Jackson and all these infrastructural problems and problems with labor and jobs and build that into reparations as well.
But I wonder if we'll ever really get them. Like, I feel like I've heard reparations since I was a little girl. I've seen it in comedies. I've seen it in movies. I've seen people talk about it. But I feel like, the question is it realistic? Will we get it? And what will it look like? And when will we get it?
I think, to go back to what DL was talking about a little bit, is that we do have to write off a certain percentage of white people as, you know, just racists that are never going to change.
Right.
But there is a percentage of white people that we can bring over, you know, to the correct
side.
What
would you say that percentage is?
I think it totally depends on age and to some extent on gender.
But all in, because here's what's interesting. No matter what, 62% of people, white people, 6 out of 10 white people voted for Donald Trump, regardless of what happened. 8 out of, almost 9 out of 10 black people voted a different way. Spanish people, 7 out of 10. Asians, 7 out of 10. So we have a diametrically opposed view of the world. But when we see racism, you see, other people see the price of doing business, you know. So how can we get, because that coalition needs to be more expansive to include people. Reverend Barber talks about poor people and how just raising the minimum wage would lift millions and millions of people, black, white, Latin, out of poverty. But just getting them to understand that they are literally in the same boat that we are would have to kill their entire notion of being what it's like to be white in America.
It's something that I think is going to take a lot of psychological work on, you know, on white. Honestly, I'm telling you that I was born into a racist family and a racist culture, educated in public racist schools. So I think it takes a lot to break out of that teaching and that mindset. And I mean, I've lost family members over it. And I think that's, you know, that's something that we really need to have a national conversation.
But it's got to be difficult, because I think there used to be a time when people respected the rule of law. They respected the Constitution. They had principles. And I think now there is a shortage of principled, well-intended white people. It really is. It's a shortage. Like, the decent white folk are pretty rare these days. And I think, and I'm talking about decent to the extent that you just don't just sit there and you're more apathetic than active. But I think that the idea that people would say, this is wrong and I am going to do what I can to change it, there's a drought of them.
I completely agree with you. And I think that that's part of my personal mission right now, is in doing something like a Civil War documentary or just doing public history in general, is that we need to democratize knowledge and democratize the knowledge of our own history and really make white people understand not only, you know, what we've done that was horribly bad in this country, but, you know, give them ways and ideas to help fix and repair what we've done.
I think it's as simple as people have to understand that what's good for us, it's good that the infant mortality rate drops. It takes the pressure off the public dole. It's good that people are educated. It's good. So all the things, it's good that people have access like to the wealth-making mechanisms of this country. It's good because it takes the onus off a lot of things. It takes the strain off some of the public structures. You are a historian. What is history telling us right now? Because you have the benefit of knowing where we are, where we've been, and seeing where we're going. So where are we now? What's the lay of the land?
I think we are at a deeply momentous time where there is a possibility for real and lasting change. And these are the kind of times that only come around maybe once or twice in a person's lifetime. And so, like I said earlier, I think we are beginning to see the start of a new civil rights movement, not only with the Black Lives Matter protests, but also with this labor movement. I always point out that, you know, if you look at the end of the civil rights movement in 1968, Martin Luther King dies leading a sanitation worker strike.
It is
a labor movement by that point. And so I think the people in Bessemer are couching it as, you know, a civil rights movement. That's exactly where we need to go with this. It's kind of picking up that civil rights movement where it left off in the 60s.
Isn't it funny? We started this experiment in Alabama and we're back there again. Isn't it funny? Like, literally, there were so many from the Birmingham the buses and the girls who were blown up, and now we're right back in there with the same kind of sentiments, tonality, and it is the epicenter of all that could be or we would go forward or stay static.
Yeah, I think it's hopeful.
They are the hope.
I think I think you are also part of the hope, because I think, you know, when I see people like you who, you know, you, like you said, you've lost family members, and you could do what a lot of young white women and men in this country do every day, and that is just get up and live their lives and not even try to discover the history of African Americans in this country and to try to do something about it.
I think we are at a moment that it's so in your face, obviously going through, especially the George Floyd trial for Derek Chauvin's murder trial right now. It is so in the face of white people that there is no excuse anymore to say I didn't know, or to say that I don't see this violence. So there has to be a reckoning right now.
We'll see. I tell you what, you're easier to look at than Ken Burns' ass. I tell you that. So thank you for joining us. Thank you, Miss Mayor. We appreciate it. Keep up the fight. Thank you.
Hey there, welcome back to DL Uncut. It's time to find out what you need to know with the one and only Sybil Wills.
Sybil! Hello, hello.
Beautiful.
Oh, lovely you. Thank you. I'm talking to you guys about spring cleaning today.
Oh, wow.
But it's spring cleaning with a twist. Ooh. Now, as we are going about doing our due diligence with our homes, and as we are scrubbing the floorboards and them walls like Grandma used to do, and we work up a sweat, we get into the shower, and we need to scrub ourselves and check ourselves. So I'm talking about spring cleaning of your body.
Oh,
okay? As you're standing there, you're checking some of those, checking some of those aches and pains. You know, Jasmine, we're told to check our breasts every month while we're in the shower and what have you. Gentlemen, there's some things you could check down there, too.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay. So
jiggle it.
This is the prelude to, as you're pulling out all those clothes and you're trying them on and you're tossing and what have you for the spring and from last winter and that. Also, this is a time to pull out the numbers of those doctors you have not seen in over a year.
Wow.
Because a lot of us have been in the house. We have not done our due diligence as far as getting all of our exams and everything done. And so this is a time to pull out the number for that primary care physician and get started, right?
Wow. Wow. When you said spring cleaning, I started to call my housekeeper. I'm like, I don't need to hear this.
It's different.
But this is...
No.
I was like, Marlene!
This is for you.
I don't need
you
this,
to
but
do.
I can say understand.
People to check your body for yourself. Well, you may. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
And this also does not apply to us as people of a certain age. This is also for young people who may be lucky enough to still be on their parents' insurance.
Absolutely.
It's a good time to get in and get those exams, get those baseline exams done on your breasts and other parts of your body, especially if you have a family history of this. And these are the baselines that they'll use for a number of years to come as you are going through this. And lastly, as we have pulled all this stuff out and we're calling organizations like our local church and the Salvation Army to come and pick up our donations, let us also, if you haven't already, reach out to Meemaw and Pawpaw.
Right.
You know why? Because they have that family history that you're going to have to share with your doctors.
Right.
If you don't already know.
Right.
Right? Now, it's going to take a while. Now, Meemaw, you said so-and-so had the sugar.
Right.
You know that's diabetes, right?
And
all of this is going on as we are, we might even have to have them say the C word.
Oh,
And that is a difficult conversation to have.
Chitlins?
This is all
No.
Some of our bodies are like that at this point, yes. But we're talking about all these things in our lives. And so spring cleaning, out with the old, in with the new, with a new attitude about our lives around us and inside of us.
Thank you, Sybil.
Thank you, Sybil.
Marlene, you can stand down
Get
now.
Get to cleaning.
That was a different thing.